ended last year was sort of all over the place. So I just want to summarize the sort of essential points about strong CP, about violation of CP by the strong interactions in the standard model. So there's two sources of CP violation in the strong interaction sector. First one is the phase of the quark mass matrix. And the second one is this theta term in the Lagrangian. Now, starting from the first one, you'd think it appears removable by an axial rotation, by a rephasing of, say, the left-handed quarks without rephasing the right-handed quarks, or vice versa. So it appears to be removable. By the symmetry I called U1A, U1 axial. Again, the symmetry where I rotate the left-handed quarks and the right-handed quarks the same way, rotated the left-handed quarks by one phase and the right-handed anti-quarks by another phase. And so it ended up not changing MQ at all. This axial rotation is the only overall rotation that changed MQ. And this, although it's a symmetry of the action, it's anomalous. And the bottom line of what this means is that instead of, so I can define a current, J mu axial, and instead of its covariant derivative being equal to zero, it's equal to some terms. There's two types of terms that arise. There's one coefficient over 64 pi squared times g mu nu a g mu nu dual a. And I'm going to start using the notation. This combination is just called g mu nu dual, so g contracted with an epsilon. Plus, there's also a term, n electromagnetism over 64 pi squared times f mu nu dual. Sorry, this is really n, yeah, well, call it n electromagnetism. And then there would also be a weak interaction term, which won't play any role at all in the physics that we'll discuss. So the symmetry is anomalous. Instead of this current being conserved, it's related to this operator. But you might ask, well, so now that tells me I can convert the phase in the determinant of the quark mass matrix into a theta term, or vice versa. So this tells us one is physical, well, one is not removable. But interchangeable with two. So now we ask, is number two physical? Is this coefficient in front of a GG dual type of interaction physical? Well, you might think that because GG dual is a total derivative, equal of this Chern class, you might think that because that's a total derivative, it doesn't contribute. But But it's a total derivative of a quantity that is engaged invariant. And that's really the sharp point. It's a del mu, k mu, and k mu is not gauge invariant. So that means that I have to be careful about whether k mu actually vanishes at the boundary or not. If k mu does have to vanish at the boundary, f mu nu has to vanish at the boundary. If k mu has to vanish at the boundary, that means that that I can forget about that term. I can write it as a boundary term that's zero in my path integral. So there's a question. Does k mu vanish at boundary? This now depends on the dimension of space-time, and it depends on the structure of your group, and basically whether one can be one, whether they can wrap around each other, the homotopy structure. Really, the ability to wrap it to wrap a function of the gauge group around space-time. So it turns out that when you think about these winding configurations, this term, the g mu nu dual for QCD, is physical. There are winding configurations that you have to include, and this term tells you how to include it. But f mu nu dual, the electromagnetic one, is not physical. Because of the difference that this has, this group, an SU3, it has spheres in it. This U1 group does not. So you can't have any non-trivial U1 wrapping consistently over the whole boundary of space-time. So this is physical, and it violates CP. Again, I can choose, once I put that coefficient in my Lagrangian, I can choose to move it back and forth, replace it with an argument of the quark mass matrix, or I can shift all of the CP violation from the quark mass matrix, for all of the strong CP violation from the quark mass matrix into this GG dual term. But I do have to include them in my theory, and their actual coefficients is determined by experiment, at least the sum of the two coefficients, which is the only physical thing, that is exceedingly small, around 10 to the minus 9, where you might have expected an order 1 number. So at the end of the day, the physical strong CP violation is determined by e to the I theta QCD times the determinant of the quark mass matrix, more specifically by its phase. And I can define a theta bar QCD to be theta QCD plus argv.m. That's the physical combination. Whether I shift things between here, I can shift things between the two pieces using a symmetry, so neither one separately is physical, but the sum is. And it appears to be small. And so we need to understand why this theta bar QCD is small. And one very, very nice proposal for this is that it's small because of a new symmetry that an enhanced symmetry if you modify the standard model. So this is the axion, what's now known as the axion idea. To add a new symmetry to the standard model, this new symmetry will also be anomalous. But spontaneous breaking of this symmetry will actually naturally lead us to have theta bar QCD small. So if we want a new symmetry under which our Yukawas are actually going to be invariant, not breaking the symmetry, but actually invariant under the symmetry, then it has to involve, so if we want things like Y up H U right conjugate Q and Y down H star D right conjugate Q. If we want these to be invariant under our symmetry, actually invariant under a symmetry that rotates the up and the quarks simultaneously in the same direction, then that symmetry also has to involve the Higgs. So it must be a symmetry that the Higgs is charged under. Actually, in order to make this idea work, we're going to need to have two separate Higgses. So the up Yukawas will come from one Higgs, H up. Down Yukawas will come from H down. Lepton Yukawas will also come from H down. Now, space there, so I'll have my hypercharge SU2 and now my new U1 named after called the Peche Quinn U1 or U1 PQ, named after Roberto Peche and Helen Quinn. So our quark fields all have the usual assignments under U1y and hypercharge, a sixth minus two-thirds, one-third. This is a doublet, these are singlets. Our H up and H down, based on those interactions, you can work out that the H down had better have a positive hypercharge. Sorry, H down needs to have a negative hypercharge. Minus a half, and H up needs to have a positive hypercharge, plus a half, in order to make those Yukawas gauge invariant. They're both SU2 doublets. And now under this Peche Quinn symmetry, I want to give axial like coupling. So U right conjugate and Q have the same charge. D right conjugate has the same charge. So I'll give each of these guys a charge of one half. Under the new U1. And now you see H up and H down each have to have what charge? Minus one, right. So if I give these guys a minus one charge, then each of these terms has minus one plus a half, and it's invariant under the U1PQ. You see, this is why I needed to have two Higgses, because if I had used H up star in the second term, it would have had a charge of plus one, and then that term wouldn't have been invariant under U1PQ. So I've introduced two Higgses. This is similar. You guys did a homework. Or maybe it was a tutorial on the Higgs sector of the supersymmetric standard model, which also had an H up and H down. But there you didn't have any symmetry restricting their interaction. So for example, there were terms in the Lagrangian that looked like h up, h down times coefficient b mu. That kind of potential is forbidden by the symmetry. So although this has the same particle content as the MSSM Higgs sector, it's very different because it has this enhanced symmetry that restricts the interactions. So I'll add a general potential of h up and h down that respects that U and PQ symmetry. Now that symmetry clearly is spontaneously broken, right? When the Higgs gets a BEV, the Higgs is charged under U and PQ. Generally, both of these will get BEVs. Both of them break U1PQ. What do you end up with? Well, just like for the weak interactions, you end up with a potential, sort of Mexican hat potential, with a bunch of minima. I'm ignoring for now the fact that the symmetry is anomalous. Just ignoring the anomaly for now. I would end up with a set of minima parametrized by a physical parameter and that I can move between them. The field that moves me between them is called the axion. So different along this valley of the potential, different positions correspond to different expectation values of the axion. In other words, I can write down my VEVs as having some V, so I'll write H down and H up, some V sine beta, V cosine beta times, I'm just looking at the zero components here, e to the I A over V. Okay? And I can choose different vacua, different expectation values. This beta, changing beta gives you physically inequivalent vacua, right? If beta is large, if sine beta is large, is small, then this VEV is very small. The mass of the down quarks is small. If sine beta is big, the VEV is big. The mass of the down quarks is big. So beta parametrizes physically inequivalent vacua. A, on the other hand, this, and that's a parameter. A here, this is really a field. This is part of the original. Now when I write expansions about so I can call this A naught. When I write expansions about this, when I write, I'd write HD0 equals some V plus a delta times e to the I A over V, right? So this A is a physical field. It's a massless field when you work it out. This is a Goldstone boson. So there's a theorem, Goldstone's theorem, that anytime you spontaneously break a symmetry, an exact symmetry, you will end up with an exactly massless pseudoscalar degree of freedom. If the symmetry were a gauge symmetry, that massless Goldstone degree of freedom you could think of as being eaten by the gauge boson. And so you can view that as either you can view that as a massless degree of freedom, or in a different gauge, you would view it as the longitudinal component of a massive vector. Those two are actually equivalent. But when it's a global symmetry, not a gauge symmetry, you always have a massless degree of freedom, massless field. That's the Goldstone boson. That is, in this case, the axion. Now, I want to consider a somewhat more general situation. Because here, the axion, the sort of characteristic scale for the axion's interactions, you remember when we did pions. All of the pions interactions were suppressed by powers of this f pi, right? And f pi is a scale characterizing the spontaneous breaking of a symmetry controls the interaction strength of the axion, of the pion. Here, in this model, that goes for the weak axion to a 1 over FA squared, right? I'm just changing my labeling. But that's always of order the electroweak vacuum, the electroweak bed, 170 GeV. It's always of this order because the thing that's spontaneously breaking the symmetry is a Higgs bed. Okay, and we'd like to consider the case 1 over FA squared, let me write it the other way. FA much greater than the standard model Higgs bed. Okay, so I'd like to build models where these two scales are independent to consider a more general class, especially because these will turn out to be have been excluded decades ago, and so I shouldn't really be talking too much about them. The way to do that is to just add a new field to my theory. It's going to be a heavy field. And I want this field to be, I want a scalar field so that it can get a vacuum expectation value. But I want this scalar field to not have any SU2 cross U1 charges. That way, its vacuum expectation value doesn't break the standard model symmetries, doesn't break electroweak symmetry. It can get an expectation value that's much higher than the standard model bev. So I'll make him neutral under U1, singlet under SU2, and now give it a charge plus 1. So now, this lets me add to my potential several kinds of terms. I can add some coefficient times h up, h down, phi squared. That's invariant under the symmetries. And then some symmetry breaking potential minus m squared mod phi squared plus lambda mod phi to the fourth. Where this m and this lambda, I'm imagining being very large. So now, m I'm imagining being very large, lambda is dimensionless. So now, U1PQ is spontaneously broken at a scale VPQ that's set by m over root lambda, right? So at that scale, set by m, I break the U1PQ symmetry. This can be much larger consistently than the standard model bev. Then the picture is that at really high energies, I break this U1PQ symmetry, I get a light axion, and then at a slightly lower energy, I hit the electroweak phase transition, breaks standard model gauge group, and then finally, at the QCD scale, I get non-perturbative effects. So all three of these scales will be important for thinking about the physics of axions. And this is the regime we want to consider, that the PQ breaking scale is much, I reversed that. Call them VPQ, which I'm also going to call basically F axion. All right. Now, I could do this whole rigmarole if we wanted to, of writing down arbitrary expectation values for these guys, diagonalizing their mass matrices, diagonalizing the kinetic terms of all the different Goldstone bosons, the ones that are going to get eaten, because I've got quite a few. I've got three that are going to get eaten by the W's and the Z's, plus this axion. I could worry about the masses of all my non-eaten Higgs bosons. Here, right, if we just do the counting, we used to have a Higgs, which had four real components. Of which three are eaten, Goldstone bosons, by the W plus or minus and the Z, plus one physical Higgs, which was discovered last year. Now, in this theory, we've got H up is a doublet, H down is another doublet, phi is a doublet. So, sorry, phi is a singlet, but it's a complex field. So we've got 10 real components. Three are eaten. One's the axion. One has a mass of order VPQ. And then the rest at the weak scale are going to be five with a mass around the electroweak scale. So my point is there's a lot of degrees of freedom in this theory. So this is, again, the 10 components broken down. There's a lot of degrees of freedom in this theory, a lot of mass matrices that we could diagonalize very carefully if we wanted to. But we don't really want to. The main thing we want to understand is an effective theory of this axion. And since we're considering a regime where these scales, VPQ and the standard model VEV, are very well separated, most of the properties of the axion are going to be controlled not by the weak scale at all, but by VPQ. So, in particular, we expect all of the axion's interactions to happen through the sort of combination e to the I axion over F axion times some order one numbers. And in general, we talk about the couplings of the Higgs when we figure out exactly how the axion enters into these VEVs, into these Higgs expectation values, we're going to be able to write down different coefficients. So I'll call them C up for the VEV of H up times some V up and H down C down times V down, where C up and C down are order one. In this particular model, they would be related to this beta parameter. Okay? But in general, they could have slightly different forms. The main thing is that they're order one dimensionless parameters. Now, when you plug that in to your theory, what are you going to get? Now you see, when we get our mass matrix, it's not just proportional to the Yukawas anymore. It's proportional to the Yukawas times e to the I axion, which means that if we look at the determinant of the quark matrix, that's going to go like the determinant of the Yukawa times V down e to the I A over FA times these C's times the number of quark flavors, NF. Okay, and the phase, argdm, goes like argdy, or I'll say argdm 0, the mass in the axion field is 0, plus A over FA. And so depending on the value of this field, Remember, this is exactly the combination that went into theta bar. Depending on the value of this field, A, you'll get a different theta bar coefficient. So now, theta bar is a function of a dynamical field. It's a function of A. And if we want to understand what this model predicts for theta bar, we have to look at the potential for A. That's nothing but a chiral Lagrangian type of effective potential. Let me bring this board back down. So I just want to sketch out what this potential is going to look like. So we expect, remember when we had our pion chiral Lagrangian, we had things like trace of sigma times the quark mass matrix plus the Hermitian conjugate of that, all multiplied by a parameter v, and that was appearing in our this v was a symmetry breaking expectation value of order the QCD scale, so I'll just call it vqcd to distinguish it from all the other vs. The problem now now sigma was equal to e to the I. I'll just focus at pi naught times a sigma matrix, so 1 minus 1, plus pi plus and minus terms that won't matter to us now. M, this is the quark mass matrix. Now I'm thinking about just the up and down quarks, right? So M is just the up and down quark mass matrix. Physical masses. But now remember, these masses depend on the axion value. So that's m up, m down, times, let's just say I've chosen a equals 0 to correspond to where the determinant here is real. Okay? So I'm just going to choose, I can shift my origin for a. The Lagrangian is invariant under that shift. So I'm going to choose a equals 0 to be the CP, the theta bar equals 0 point. And I'm going to choose to write things with theta equals 0 and argdetm just equal to A over FA. Okay, so that then A equals 0 doesn't need imply theta equals 0. So it's this times some phases, e to the I, c up a over fa, e to the I, c down a over fa, which I could just write as m up, m down, e to the I, c up a over fa, the matrix C down A over FA. Right, so now I've got this written in a way that the axion field, let me make it a little more explicit, and this is obviously over F pi. If I write it this way, so just a coefficient matrix times A over FA, the axion and the pion are now appearing in a very similar way in these interactions. And I can look at those, just manipulate those a little bit. What I'm going to find is that I end up with this being equal to, there's an m up term times v, QCD, times a cosine of pi over FA over F pi minus C up A over FA, or I guess plus an M down term, BQCD cos pi over F pi minus C down A over F A. So all I'm doing is I'm taking these matrices and then focusing on the diagonal parts, right? These pi plus minus, those are multiplied by things like plus one with off diagonal terms. And when I multiply that matrix by these matrices, by this M matrix, that's the same as adding the exponents. There's not going to be any crosstalk between the pi plus minus masses and the axion mass, only the pi zero. I get these two terms. There's other terms associated to the anomaly that I won't talk about. But this is the kind of structure you can get, which already motivates what the mass, what the order of magnitude for the mass of the axion is. And when the dust settles, the mass of the axion squared, the parameter you get out of expanding this to quadratic order in the axion field, and then making sure that everything's diagonalized, is controlled by, so let me first sketch it out. It's going to be of order quark mass times VQCD. Over, sorry, just a second. Over F axion squared, and then the reason I'm stalling here is that I've forgotten to make my term in the potential dimension four. So this is dimensionless, this has dimension one, VQCD has dimension one. You would expect in the pi on Lagrangian for this to have an overall f pi squared out front. And that enters into the mass matrix as well. All right, and if you remember, m quark times VQCD over just by itself, that was setting the pion mass. So I can relate this to m pi squared times f pi squared over f axion squared. There's some precise dependence on the ratio of up and down quark masses as well. Now, if I had FA of order the weak scale, that would give me an axion mass around 25 keV. For FA of order V standard model. What else can I say about properties of the axion? So this is one important property that we'll come back to. Sorry, I'm gonna make that board reappear. Another important property is the interactions of the axion, right? So how does the axion interact? Well, so this is actually quite easy to read off of what we've already understood about where the axion shows up in the Lagrangian. Remember, we expect some dependence on the axion field, A over F axion. And so this was for the original, this A over V was for the original model where F axion was just the same as V standard model because I hadn't added phi. This becomes an axion over F axion in the general case. So now I'm going to have these interactions that are basically now proportional to the fermion mass times e to the I A over FA times quark bilinear. So if I have MQ e to the IA over FA, Q right conjugate Q left, then, and also the same for the leptons, then when I write down the leading interaction for that, just by expanding out the exponential, I get an interaction that looks like MQ over FA times A Q right, Q left. So, and this has mixing. So in any kind of quark, incoming quark, outgoing quark process, I could radiate off an axion. I can also absorb axions this way. Now, I'd also expect some interaction with gluons coming from this GG-dual interaction. That ends up not being so important because we're mostly dealing with quark-bound states. And gluons, after all, you don't have light gluons in your final low-energy theory. A more interesting point is this interaction with F mu nu. Now, I said this FF dual interaction term, the coefficient in front of it, isn't physical because FF dual is a total derivative. But if I have now an axion field, instead of just a static theta, I have an axion field in front of that, in front of that F mu nu tilde. Doesn't matter that it's a total derivative. I can't get rid of it at the boundary because a total derivative multiplied by a field isn't a total derivative anymore. So I have to keep track of this A, F mu nu dual interaction. This lets me get, in much the same way that the pion decays, this lets me do A, sorry, that Riemann diagram makes no sense. Gamma gamma also lets me produce from an incoming fo a photon can actually emit an axion. And interestingly, these don't both have to be on-shell photons. If I have a background magnetic field, and so this is some background, and this photon corresponds to some background magnetic field, it can convert an axion, a photon into an axion, or vice versa. In the presence of some magnetic field, this F mu nu takes on some, F mu nu dual takes on some expectation value. And now this looks like just a mass mixing, or a sort of, it's a sort of a funny mixing because it has one derivative in it. A mixing of A with a photon. So I can actually convert photons into axions or vice versa. This coupling here is the reason we don't like the weak scale axion model anymore. Because this coupling would allow things like kaons decaying into a pion plus an axion. And in fact, the branching ratio that you could compute from that model, right, this weak scale axion model has very essentially no free parameters. I mean, it has free parameters, but they're order one. Has no free parameters with huge variations because the F scale is set to the standard model, BEV, electroweak symmetry breaking scale. M axion is totally determined by F axion. And so we know that should be a 25 keV axion. We can calculate its branching ratio. The branching ratio that you'd expect for electroweak axions in the models, based on the models that Petchin and Quinn originally proposed, although the axion properties themselves were worked out by other people, this branching ratio would be about 10 to the minus 5. And what's actually, this has actually been searched for, it's been bounded. And the bound is about 3 times 10 to the minus 8 from KEK. So, okay, no electroweak axions. But the rest of this parameter space, non-electroweak axions, is extremely interesting. One of the most interesting things you can look for based on this process means that if you have protons and neutrons hanging out inside a star, even for electrons hanging out inside a star, there's a process where your proton just scatters electromagnetically off somebody else. And or he has a strong interaction scatter in a neutron star, it's more likely that he'd have a strong interaction scatter with a neutron. And radiates off an axion.
This is a very suppressed process.
The cross section compared to is comparable to the cross section for producing photons times basically the ratio of this coupling, mq over f axion squared is controlling the couplings, you know, relative to some alpha, if I'm comparing to a photon emission. I compare it to alpha. This is a really, really small number. So the production is quite rare. But the point is that these axions in the core of a star, they can travel a lot farther than a photon. So whereas photons would immediately get reabsorbed in another collision after traveling, you know, a centimeter or less, these, depending on FA, can make it out to the boundary of the star, and they're a new cooling source, a new source of luminosity for the star. And if you demand that the luminosity of say, the sun in axions, that had better be less than the luminosity of the sun in photons, because people have done stellar equilibrium calculations. We know that they describe the dynamics of the sun fairly well. And we also know that if the luminosity was changed by a lot, the whole life cycle of the star would change by a lot. So this is a pretty safe assumption that the sun isn't producing as much, as isn't as bright in axions as it is in photons. And this sets a bound, not so much from the sun. There's actually tighter bounds from other kinds of stars, that the scale F axion should be greater than about 10 to the 8 GeV. So this is much higher than the standard model. This is saying if the axion solves a strong CP problem, there really should be new physics at a higher scale associated with it. Perhaps one more interesting...
Sorry.
Yeah.
So good.
So the axion, if QCD weren't explicitly breaking the symmetry, then they would be massless. Because the symmetry is anomalous, they get a mass from QCD. Okay, and because the mass is, so it's not just because it's anomalous, also just because it is a symmetry that, once the Higgs gets a VeV, the symmetry is explicitly broken by the quark masses. So it does have a mass. This is what I calculated for a standard model F. It's approximately massless in the limit that you ignore all the low energy physics that explicitly breaks this new symmetry. Sorry, I wasn't clear about that. So another very fun thing about axions, possibly more than fun, possibly important to understanding the universe, is that they can be a dark matter candidate. So if I sketch out the axion potential, it's not massless. It has sort of very, very low periodic potential coming from QCD. The fact that it's periodic is just coming from the fact that it's really all coming from a phase, from those cosine terms. In some sense, there's an equivalence between the axion field being 1 and 1 and being 2 pi isn't really physically different in any local sense. Let's say this is one of the minima where theta bar equals 0. This is what I call that A equals 0 when I chose my normalization there. The point is that this potential also depends on temperature. And at high, so here I've drawn it for low temperatures, where the symmetry breaking by QCD is maximally effective. At higher temperatures, it turns out that this potential is actually seriously damped by So there's a few different ways of modeling it. It's all, since this is set by non-perturbative physics, it's not easy to do analytically. But what people find is that the axion mass scales like some very small parameter times lambda QCD to the fourth over f axion squared. This small parameter is basically related to the quark masses. So I could have rewritten this in terms of f pi's and m pi's times the temperature over lambda QCD. This is now for temperatures larger than lambda QCD to some power that is sort of fit numerically to be around 6, or I think 6.5 in the paper I was looking at. In other words, at high temperatures, this mass is very heavily suppressed. And so there's no reason to expect that in the early universe, the axion started out down here at the minimum of its potential. You would expect that in the early universe, before the QCD phase transition, the axion started out at some value out here. This is A initial. And now you know that cosmology is going to start doing something interesting. So at first, the axion starts out at its initial value, no particular reason to pick the CP invariant point. The universe cools through the QCD phase transition. All of a sudden, the axion field is now being driven by a significant potential compared to the temperature. And so it starts rolling in this potential well. And that oscillation of a field, that's nothing but a sort of, that can be interpreted as if you have the Vev of phi changing, of the axion field changing. That can be interpreted as some coherent condensate of axions. And in particular, it's clear that it carries energy density everywhere. And if you study its cosmology, that energy density essentially behaves like cold dark matter. So now you ask, how much of this do you expect? And it can account, it's about the right amount to account for the dark matter density. Omega axion is generically, for generic initial values, is generically of order the measured dark matter density if F axion is in the neighborhood of 10 to the 11 to 10 to the 13 GeV, or masses around 1 to 20 microelectron volts. So this is a dark matter candidate. Anything that could be the dark matter and could explain a rather salient feature of QCD, why it respects the CP symmetry, is something you should look for. How do people look for this? Well, first step is to understand what this mass scale corresponds to physically. So of course, this is a large F. The interactions are all suppressed by energy over F, or mass over F, of standard model particles. So we are definitely talking about coupling constants of order 10 to the minus 10, you know, 10 to the, more than that, 10 to the minus, for MeV mass particles, 10 to the minus 16, 10 to the minus 14, tiny couplings. So we're going to need to use high power effects to look for these. The mass of the axion is 1 to 20 microelectron volts. Let's convert that to a frequency. The frequency turns out to be right around a gigahertz. Well, that's good news. That's a frequency that we've actually heard of in terrestrial applications. Now, if you imagine gigahertz light going through a magnetic field can convert into these photons, sorry, into these axions, or axions can convert into gigahertz photons. How do you measure gigahertz photons? Well, that's a microwave. If you ask what's a gigahertz photon, the wavelength for a gigahertz photon is around 30 centimeters.
And so there's an experiment, AVMX, that has been building these resonant cavities. The idea is you have a microwave cavity that's tuned to have a resonant frequency of a gigahertz.
Now,
when I say tuned to have a resonance frequency of a gigahertz, I mean they're actually doing like a 10 to the minus 6 tuning to a particular band of 1.07291 gigahertz. And then they do a search for 3 weeks. And then they switch to 1.02972 gigahertz, do a search for a few weeks. I had an amusing conversation with a grad student on this experiment once. I told him it must be so exciting that every couple of weeks you switch to a new band and you're equally likely to see axions as you were the first week. Most experiments, you're most likely to see something in the first week. And then after that, you know, the other weeks, it's less likely that you'll find something. ADMX must be really cool. And it is really cool. He agreed that it was a really cool experiment. But I guess after many weeks of only going 10 to the minus 6 at a time, he didn't quite share my enthusiasm about every week being, or, you know, every week being as unlikely to discover as the last one. So very finely tuned, so that and then you have a magnetic field going through this resonant cavity. And the idea is that if you have nothing going on in the cavity, but it's tuned to be resonant to a particular frequency, magnetic field is going through the field of dark matter axions. If it can excite some of those dark matter axions to convert into photons and then you detect them, then you'd have a signal of dark matter axions. So this is an experiment that's underway to search for this scenario, which right now is probably one of the most interesting ways that axions could connect strong CP to other aspects of physics. You'll also notice that this field, this mass scale, is getting high enough that it starts being connected to other, being close to other scales you speculate about. Could it be related to the scale possible grand unification around 10 to the 16 GeV? Well, in that case, you would have naively expected the axion density to actually be about 1,000 times bigger than the dark matter density. But it's possible that with a little bit of fine-tuned initial conditions, perhaps gut scale axions could also be a consistent dark matter candidate. Yeah?
I want to know if actions are from supersymmetric breaking or from asymmetric breaking.
They're from this Peche-Quinn symmetry breaking.
I see.
Yeah, so the symmetry that I just erased, they're the goldstone of that PQ symmetry. So actually, this is a sort of nice lead-in, nice tie-off to the course and lead-in to David's course on dark matter coming later on. Yeah, I'll just let you guys ask questions about anything else for a few minutes, if you have any.
So this is also the basis for those light shining through walls experiments, right?
Right. Now, light shining through walls experiments. So here I talk specifically about axions that get their mass mainly from QCD. And they have to get their mass mainly from QCD in order to solve the strong CP problem. You could have similar dynamics, so-called axion-like particles. But they're actually getting their mass not from QCD, but from some other strongly interacting physics. Those are called axion-like particles. And the light shining through walls experiments are mainly looking for axion-like particles. So if you draw a plot of mass versus F, F inverse. So QCD predicts a line like this. Right? The higher the mass, the smaller F has to be to generate it, because the mass goes like F, M pi, F pi over F axion. And these light shining through walls experiments are mainly looking sort of up here at I think they tend to look at sort of visible to UV light. So being the thing that's converting, so they're looking at masses close to there, and Fs that are somewhat smaller, slightly higher couplings than you would need in order to get such a mass from QCD axions. That particular mass range for QCD axions is also ruled out by the stellar constraints. But I believe there's some room up here. So yeah, light shining through walls. Same general idea of using this interaction with a magnetic field to convert, instead of converting axions into photons, to convert photons into axions. Since you don't need axions in the initial state, this could find axions even if they have nothing to do with dark matter. Whereas here you're relying on an initial state with axions, so you kind of need axion dark matter for this operating, for that strategy to work.
Thank you, Kelly.